Hey everybody, it's Connor. Thank you so much for joining us for another wonderful episode of our podcast Drama with Connor and Dylan McDowell. If this is your first time listening, thank you for joining us. Make sure you follow us on, Instagram at the Drama Podcast, on Twitter at the Drama Podcast, on TikTok, which is a slightly different handle that's escaping me right now, but just like search us on TikTok and you'll find us. We are so thrilled to share this episode with you today with Martina Mayoc. Obsessed with her. She is everything. You're going to absolutely love it. If you love it, if you love us, again, you've already followed us, you've subscribed, et cetera, et cetera. But leave us a review on Apple, on Spotify, everywhere, because that really helps us pop up in the charts. And in addition to all of that admin that I just shared with you, I know this is a lot for a summer's day, but I want to encourage you to go to patreon.com/thedramapodcast, where for $5 a month, you get extra bonus episodes with Dylan and I chatting. It's really fun. We talk about theater. We talk about pop culture. We talk about love. We talk about life, and which is sort of the thesis of the pod. But additionally, you get access to our Instagram close friends, where every single day we are shit posting funny, fun, horny, insane, wonderful, insightful, spicy takes and things. So definitely going to want to join the Drama Plus family when you sign up for $5 at patreon.com/thedramapodcast. We love you so much. Thank you for joining us. Tell all your friends. See you later.
Press play.
Curtain of an hour in.
It's time to take spin.
The shade and tea to spill.
Ooh, drama.
Oh, that's a tweet. Did they book?
Who got nom?
They option no.
Oh, I'm not well.
What star will we talk to today? Oh, that's a gag, honey. Say no more. Drama.
Drama. Welcome to Drama, a podcast that covers theater,
pop culture,
love,
and life.
I am Connor McDowell.
And I am Dylan McDowell.
Dylan, what is going on? I feel like we haven't recorded in forever, even though we just did last week, which is an interesting concept.
I know. Well, we're freshly back from Palm Springs.
Yes.
Our first ever trip. And I must say, I'm really proud of us. We wore sunscreen. Our gentle Irish skin did get a slight, I don't want to call it a tan, but it crisped up.
You look redder than I do.
Yeah. Well, I was being a little riskier. It was over 100 degrees every day. It was one of the most fun trips I've ever been on in my life.
Oh my God. Same. I completely agree. It was so relaxing. I mean, obviously it was an escape and Palm Springs is like not a real place. Like it's just how hot it is, how peaceful. I loved every second.
It really reminded me of the movie Don't Worry, Darling.
Which I think was shot there, wasn't it?
In the area or something.
The Miss Flow vehicle, the Olivia Wilde.
Mm-hmm.
Wait, was the movie the idea of you about Olivia and Harry? Someone said that recently on a podcast, which I know means it was totally true.
No.
What was it?
No,
what was no, like no, just no. fan fiction?
I think it was just fan fiction, yeah.
They're done, right? Yeah.
The Anne Hathaway movie?
Yeah. Which yeah, I loved. That's my.
I need to watch the other Anne Hathaway movie. Or no, it's Nicole Kidman. Sorry, it's Nicole Kidman and Zac Efron that's on Netflix
oh,
right now.
Wait, I feel like I haven't seen much about that other than he's like doing tons of press.
It's another like age gap romance, which we love.
He looks great. I'm not. I feel like his filler is dissolving a little bit or something. He looks a lot better. Wait, Palm Springs was so fun. The group we were with was amazing. It was just nice to escape real life for a second, like truly get out of the city, into the sunshine, lay around in a pool, do nothing. I realize I need to do that more.
Yeah. And also, I have an addendum. Last week, you mentioned in our interview with Tom Pasinka that you saw the best drag brunch of your life in Hell's Kitchen. I think I saw the best drag brunch ever in Palm Springs.
Ooh, oh, that was so good. I loved it. They pulled out all the stops.
I know. But listen, we're back in our homes. We're back to the drama. And we have a gaggy guest today.
I'm so excited. This timing is perfect.
I know.
Because the show that everyone is waiting for is currently happening in Boston, Gatsby and American Myth.
But it's been under lock and key, which I have to respect.
It has. You know? It has. It's like, that is so true. It's top secret. Even though it's in performances, I feel like I'm still like, what is going on over there at ART?
I believe they do the yonder bags during the show.
The yonders?
Mm-hmm. The yonder.
Take me out style.
Take me out style.
Oh my God. Does this mean that Isaac Powell shows full hog in Gatsby and American? No one will know.
No one would
they
know.
See it.
No one would know. I know.
Damn.
Wow.
Oh my God. Okay. I need to go. I need to see it right now. The musical, that is. The musical.
Of course.
Right, of course. But Dylan, I'm going to read this lovely bio that you put together. And it had to be edited for some brevity here because our guest is accomplished as hell.
I mean, the accolades are countless.
It's crazy. And now becoming a member of the drama family, I mean, that should just be stuck to the end. But all right, Dylan, your words and my lips. Our guest today is a modern icon and queen of the theater. Born in Poland and raised in working class immigrant communities in New Jersey and Chicago, this brilliant playwright's works explore the complexities of human connection, social justice, and economic disparity, and give voice to underrepresented communities. She was awarded the 2018 Pulitzer Prize for Drama for her Broadway debut play, Cost of Living, which was also nominated for the Tony Award for Best Play. Her other major works that have been produced in America and across the globe include Sanctuary City, Queens, and Ironbound. Her most current project is Gatsby, An American Myth, a new musical for which she wrote the libretto with music by Florence Welch and Thomas Bartlett, which runs through August 3rd at the American Repertory Theater. Selections from her countless awards and recognitions include a Guggenheim Fellowship, the Steinberg Playwright Award, Arthur Miller Foundation Legacy Award, the Obie Award for Playwriting, the Hull Warner Award, the Hermitage Greenfield Prize as the first female recipient in drama, the Champions of Change Award from the NYC Mayor's Office, and more. This queen has also developed TV projects for HBO and is writing feature films for Plan B, Pastel, MGM, Orion, among others. Are you gagged? We sure are. Please, welcome to drama, Martina Myok.
I love you guys. I love you guys so much.
It's mutual. It's mutual, Martina.
Joy.
We're stoked to have you on here. We love to check in with our guests right from the top. Are you well?
I am very well. Thank you.
It feels like a good Friday in New York City for you.
Beautiful. I love summer. Like there's love abounds. Like July's busting out all over. Like it's great. I'm well. Are you well?
Yeah.
I'm great.
Have you ever been to Palm Springs?
No, I'd love to, though. Apparently, you go back in time when you go to Palm Springs.
You do. It, honestly, even the villa that we stayed at had all the signage around that, like, allegedly it belonged to, like, Jackie Kennedy Onassis's ex-husband. All this stuff, because they had found a dog collar that was engraved with the Onassis name, and so they just believed that happened. I liked to buy into the fantasy.
I love a myth.
You do.
Yeah. You do.
Wait, but I have a quick question for you. This Gatsby, An American Myth, you know, the title. Originally, it was called Gatsby for a really long time. Anyways, did you have any say in the title of this musical?
Yeah, we deliberated a bunch to what was the sort of tag on to have people to it's. I mean, it's the first invitation to your experience is the title. And the story itself feels like our iconic myth in the way that the Greeks had their myths. Like it's the story of who we would like to be, who we think ourselves to be as Americans, as manifested, not just Gatsby, but in like Gatsby in a sense is a concept as much as it is a person. And sort of also an invitation to us all as Americans that this is a story that we all share.
Wow.
Oh my God. That was full so beautifully body said. Okay, wait, we're going to get fully into Gatsby in a second. But I just want to say shout out to Bobby Conti, who literally has been pitching you to our podcast for months now.
Love my love.
We're obsessed with him. We had him on our show. I think it was like, Dylan, your memory is way better than mine. Mm-hmm. The day after company closed?
Yeah. It was like I think they closed maybe July or August. And it was like the first Tuesday. And he was like, you know, normally at this time of night, I'd be getting ready to go on stage, but I'm glad I'm doing something instead. So I'm not sad. It was so cute.
Wait, and oh my God, he had just gotten the cutest haircut post. Because I don't know.
Did I you love know the him? Long hair.
You did?
Yeah. You love the long hair?
I like them both.
Were you guys together at that time? No. Or was it later?
I actually met him on the very first reading of Gatsby on American soil. Because we developed a lot of it in London since Flo was in London. And it was the first cold read. And we were sat next to each other. And I thank the fates. I was like, the script was so in process that there was just whole hunks missing. But I talked about these characters for so long. It was constantly in development. And Rachel gave me the floor to go one by one to all the actors to tell them my intention for who these characters are. And I thought that was a lovely thing to be able to share like what I hope for them that may not be on the page, but is still in process. And so I went one by one by one. And I was like, oh, look, look at me. I'm so literate. I'm so articulate. Like, boom, 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 boom. And Bobby was next to me. He was last. And I got to Bobby and go, ha, ba, 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 ba. I was just like, so he claims that I was very, but I just felt like a fucking idiot. Just like, I was like looking at his face and I was like, I cannot focus. And a room of 50 people are watching me talk to this man.
And you left that day and you said, he can never be in this show because we will never get any work done.
Totes.
Oh, that's so cute. Who was he playing?
He was playing Wilson.
Oh, great.
One of my favorite, dearest characters. Yeah.
Maybe a little misunderstood sometimes.
Oh, well, they're all misunderstood. All of them. I feel like it is, oh God, I love this book so much. You know, it's like noon on a Friday and I'm going to probably weep a few times because I love this book so much. I love the story and I love these characters. And I feel like, especially the working class characters have been portrayed as these cartoons with no dignity in so many of the film adaptations that I've seen.
Yeah.
And it breaks my fucking heart because just reading the book, I can feel their life pulsing from the page. I know these people. I've been a version of these people. And Wilson is definitely one of those characters that's seen as this like sad sack cuckold. But I'm like, this is an honest man. Mm. This is a man that has worked his whole life believing that if he just, he's my mother. He's somebody who, my mother cleaned houses and worked in factories when we first came to the country. And America did not prioritize the work that she did in order to afford her a certain type of life of safety. And the idea of this, the American dream, saying that if you just work hard enough, like you should be able to attain safety and not just safety, but transcendence. And it's just that the work that she did, this honest physical work that she did, wasn't valued. And I think of all these bankers and all the people who are in their suits. I'm like, look at my mother's broken body. And I dare you to tell her that she hasn't worked hard enough. Mm. And that is how I see Wilson, is somebody who's just like, I believe in the dream of this country. I'm going to do it the honest way. And the country does not pay him back.
Yeah.
And the marriage fractures largely because of his clinging to honesty, which, like, you know, it's tragic. And I feel it's deep, deep, deep to my heart.
Yeah, that's really powerful. I mean, the idea that the American dream isn't just this rags to riches. Sometimes it's just what it is in someone's being, and that it's not, like, sometimes it's a struggle that you never reach. I think that's really powerful and interesting that you're able to explore that, when sometimes I think the focus is just on who is Jay Gatsby or Daisy or things like that.
And Jay Gatsby to me is a working class character. Like, he came from nothing. He worked, he you know, he's also in like a, there's an immigrant sensibility or an otherness in his mentality of having to, a feeling he has to change himself to make himself matter in this world, to make himself worthwhile for the dominant culture. You know, he literally changes his name. Yeah. It's from James Katz to Jay Gatsby. And I don't think that sort of mentality of never enoughness really leaves. I feel it all the time. I'm constantly looking over my shoulder for like the next, like impending chaos or catastrophe. I never feel safe. I can see myself so deeply in Gatsby, because he is when you don't achieve the American dream. I mean, America's got great PR. They're like, sure, come here. It'll be fine. You can, like, if you just work hard. But then when you don't, when you see other people ascending in ways that you might not be, what you oftentimes don't look at is like how other people started at a higher playing field than you did, and all the obstacles that may have been, you know, in your way, but yet you still harbor that shame of feeling as though you're unworthy based on what you've been able to attain in like the Hunger Games of the fucking American society.
Mm-hmm. Wow. I love that this has sort of been a theme that's been able to kind of carry through a lot of your works. And unfortunately, I didn't get to see Cost of Living, but Connor did get to see it shortly after. Was it like early when Broadway came back?
It was fall 2021 or 22?
Fall 22, actually. And that was the day that it closed was the next day we did the Gatsby reunion by Bobby.
Oh, wow. Okay, wait. So that reading, did you say that was in America?
Yeah, it was in New York. It was the first American reading we had, cold reading we had of the show.
How'd it go?
I was so embarrassed because there was just chunks missing. I am so frustrated because I was like, I want you to see what's inside my heart, but it's not there yet. But the producer was like, we must. This is when everyone's here. And so we did it. And there were still the moments of swelling where I thought, okay, great, this is it. I can see the character. I can feel there's something true here. But it was, yeah, it's always so embarrassing. First years are always, I usually come in like a little oiled up, you know what I mean? Like, not, like just have like a drink or two, like ready to go. Cause it's just so nerve wracking. The purpose of a first read is to get to the second one.
With musicals too. And I know this is the first like major musical that that's been produced that you're a part of, but I feel like it's so often easy to blame the book writer if something doesn't go right or if there's something missing. So I'm sure there's a little extra pressure there too.
Oh God, I was talking to Chris Diaz about this. He was like, we in the breakdowns of just payment, it's music, lyrics, and book. And he was like, you know, but book isn't just dialogue, it's also the architecture of the entire story. Shouldn't we get like another one that's like for like the story
Yes. Right.
orchestrating the dialogue? If music and lyrics are separate when they're also obviously so in harmony with each other, shouldn't story and the actual libretto? Because the conversations I had with what I'm finding with a fruitful musical collaboration is wanting to make the same thing with your collaborators, having as many conversations, personal conversations about the source material, a deep love. I can't imagine adapting something I didn't love this deeply because it is so fucking hard.
I'm sure.
And it's been years of your life, right?
Years, but also less than I mean, like we didn't do 13 years like they did for, you know, Hadestown or actually also for Hell's Kitchen. Like there was, you know, qu quicker, but yeah, there's just clinging to like what the North Star, what is important to you, in because of early conversations and then trust and loving what somebody does on their own. Like I love Florence's music. I love Thomas's music. Florence saw a bootleg recording of Sanctuary City that we did right before the pandemic when we thought like we're gonna bring back again, but please record this for posterity, please. And she saw that and responded. She said that she responded to the yearning and the feral hunger, and those became our sort of tonal North Stars, was yearning and feral hunger within the book. And addiction was a thing that came up, and the never enoughness. And so just from our first conversations through the end, I find myself in her music. She finds herself in my scenes. And it's just this most beautiful, this is like the closest I could imagine to like having a child, is like here, this deep trust and hope for the well-being of this thing that you love so much for other people, and then you let it go off and have its own life and hope that it does good in other people's lives.
Yeah.
And then this first mounting that's happened here in Boston, I should say, have you had to kill your darlings?
Oh my God,
Really?
every day. I have a hard time responding to like you must or you can't or you so like notes. I want to know the problem versus somebody else's what they think is the solution. And so it's not that I'll get a note and then like murder a darling, but I'll get a note or I'll see something that doesn't quite feel right, and it takes maybe like a day or so to figure out. It might actually be expansion of something as opposed to cutting something.
Oh.
There's the process of diagnosis of a note and an issue that is, it's fun puzzle work. But yes, the murders have all been consensual. I was like, oh yes, this is what must go so that something else can live and breathe better. Yeah, it's my first musical collaboration. So I come from the world of playwriting where I'm like, you can't change a period to a question, which still in musicals, you can't change a period to a question mark. The Dramatists Guild still protects writers in that regard. So people can really make you feel like you have to. But say to all you librettists, burgeoning librettists, pro librettists, like, you don't have to take every note. Like hold on to the things that are deeply important to you, that if you feel like they would be lost, your soul would wither just a bit. Because when your bones are dust, the things that will remain are going to be these words of yours on the page. And so just remember that. And like listen to your collaborators, take in all the things, listen to the audience. The audience actually, I feel, is the most important collaborator after a certain point, is listening to like how their bodies respond to a moment. You can't sort of you don't really lie when you laugh. You don't lie when you gasp. That's true, you know. You also don't lie when you start to cough and like look in your back for you know, and like lean back. Like that's also useful, a useful note.
Of course.
But also just hold on to the things that are the core of why you're doing this at all.
That's really profound.
Where did you come into that process too, then? Like, you're so passionate about the source material, and who invited you on board then?
Or was it you? Were you like, I'm writing a Gatsby musical and Miss Flo, here we go.
Actually, well, Rebecca Frecknell had been working on, Florence had written a few songs, and they thought maybe they could just get by without a libretto. And yeah. Rebecca had just, we just worked together on Sanctuary City. I was her first new play experience. She'd always done revivals, primarily mm-hmm. done revivals, and also her first American theater experience. And so, and it was like, and welcome to the pandemic was her reward. and all your hard work, and now we shut it down. I actually had a similar thing with as company did, where we didn't get, well, they opened, we didn't get to open. I was a few previews away, and then they brought us back, you know, at the start of the, I think the pandemic, or end, quote unquote, the reignition of yeah. the theater.
At New York Theater Workshop, right?
Yeah.
That's where I got my start in the city. They gave me my first internship out of college, and I was there for like 6 months. Actually, Hadestown was debuting there at the time.
Well, I hope that was a good experience. I love them.
Oh, I loved it. They were the most hardworking, nice theater people that I have ever encountered over the last 8 years. Jim Nicola, Jeremy Blocker. Wow. Actually, Rachel Chafkin was there. And yeah. I remember like seeing her like sitting on the stoops of the steps, like with a notebook. I remember being like so hungry for, you know, entering the theater world and being like, this is so cool. I feel like Hadestown's going to be a hit.
That was actually my first artistic experience in the city as well. I was a 2050 fellow. Oh. And it was just, there's something about that building that you're just like, artists live here.
Yes.
Artists live here. You can like, you can feel it. It's so inspiring.
Yeah. Was that her name? Linda?
Linda Chapman?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Jim Nicola, Linda Chapman. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, such good people.
Yeah. It's all just good people there.
So you're talking about working with Rebecca.
Yeah. So she, because we filmed that bootleg, when they were like, I think we need a librettist, I think she put me forward, or there was a list made, or and I was on the list, and she shared the recording of Sanctuary City with Flo. And so then we had a conversation, and actually I read the book, and I was so moved. I was so grateful to have had that book returned to my life, because I read it in high school, but it didn't have an impact on me then. And I, you know, it was the beginning of the pandemic. There was something about reading that book in my 30s. I'm still in my 30s, let's just say, but like, you know, just
hell yeah.
Just to be clear.
But your read is 25. I mean,
thanks. Yeah. But it was the beginning of the pandemic. Everything that I had valued, I was told, does not matter. The theater is closed. We can do without your life's work. Thank you very much. And like, go find some purpose elsewhere in this country of bounty that is clearly not taking care of its citizens. And the last bit of the book, I listened to the audiobook, because I like walk through Fort Tryon, Wood Hill Park, and just get lost. And it helps me to hear a story so I can imagine things visually and just write the notes. And walking about makes me, it jogs my creativity. And so I was walking in like the fucking woods of upstate Manhattan. And I got to the last page, that the We Beat On section, and I practically fell to my knees in the woods. I was so moved. I just felt like that was the clearest translation of the American soul that I had ever encountered. It was so relentlessly hopeful, and yet at the same time, so clear-eyed about who we are, that the dream itself is so beautiful. It's something absolutely worth reaching for. And yet the methods by which we've tried to pursue it have been so destructive and violent to so many people. And that these dualities just coexist, that it's beautiful, and yet we've done it so poorly. Maybe we can just, and maybe it's impossible, but maybe it's possible, and we have to keep on. And then until one fine morning, dash. We've been on boats against the current, or Brexit against the past. And I just lost my mind. I lost my mind. And so when I came back to the meeting, I was like, listen, whatever you choose to do, like, at the very least, thank you so much for having this book brought back into my life, because I love, it's become like a deep love of mine.
Wow. And sort of the parallelism of like 1920s, 2020s, this 100 years later, emerging from the rubble of this massive event. I mean, we just coming out of the pandemic and.
Yeah, that was a huge thing for me, because I had a really hard time writing original work during the pandemic. It felt impossible to respond to the moment while I was still very, very deeply in the middle of the moment. But I need to process who I am through writing. I wish there was a different way, because I actually hate writing. It's such agony. Like, why would we choose this? I hate sitting for too long. Like, all of it, solitude, I don't like it. Like, it's the only way by which I get the ticket into the rehearsal room to be able to work with collaborators to make this story the truest version of itself that it could be. But by the end of a process of developing a work, it becomes smarter than I ever was on my own. And I just fucking love that process more than anything anything, maybe like one thing I like more, but like there's, well, like it's a close second.
He's sitting in the other room watching Wimbledon.
But it's a close second.
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
Pandemic. Sorry. I was talking about the pandemic. I'm like, I'm distracted. to know that this novel is set 4 years after the end of a world war and a pandemic that collectively killed a third of the world, mostly young people. Then I understood the gin and the parties and the feral hunger and the quest for meaning, for something to make it worth the death and destruction that all these people experienced. You can, you know, it was very hot back summer, like that, like the Gatsby, like, I gotta live. I have to, I almost died or my friends died. I have to, and what does living mean here? Mm-hmm. And look at those other people, especially for the working class perspective, look at those other people who seem to have access to more life. How do I get there? Like, that's actually the quest for class ascension, is just access to more life that I saw in these characters that kind of was illuminated to me because of the time period that they were living in.
Wow. You, I feel like I was already excited for Gatsby, but now I'm even more excited to see what you guys have done, because it sounds like you truly have this emotional connection to this, to the piece. And also, I feel like, well, I guess I'll start with a question. What do you think would surprise people about Gatsby and American Myth that might be different from the books, the other, you know, films, the other musicals, anything that's been put out there about Gatsby?
I think the internal life and illumination of the circumstances of certain characters that have been typically portrayed in different ways. Like, that's very broad, but I had a hard time accessing Daisy for one. She's from such a different world. Like, my rage, I feel such rage for like people who can just fucking get away with murder because of the world that they're born into, because of being, you know, appraised more valuably in society. I'm like, you did wrong. And I struggled to get into her until I realized that she's in an abusive relationship with her husband. She talks about him having smashed her finger in the first chapter of the book. And he's described as having a cruel body. And I grew up in a lot of domestic violence. My mother was with a pretty abusive man for about 12 years. And I write a lot about it in my plays. Mm-hmm. And so then I felt a deep like care for this person who didn't know that there was potentially another form of a life that she could be living. Like, she may look at her glittering life and think, well, this is the best it's going to get. Like, who do I think I am to leave from this level of safety? And I've been in that position in a very different guise, but I've been in that situation before. And so she's also one of the smartest people in the book. She's got some of the best fucking snappy lines. Like, like, she drags people. It's fantastic. And she's oftentimes portrayed in like a lot of the film adaptations as this like wispy kind of butterfly dum-dum, mm-hmm. that I'm like, I think he was just, you, she's got a fucking anger that I'm like, okay, cool. Now I see you. I know you. Myrtle, Jesus, that is my fucking heart. That character is my fucking heart in this adaptation. I see myself in that lady. She's got a fucking feral drive to like make herself matter and feel safe in a way that feels potentially impossible for somebody from her station, especially as a woman at that time. I made it a rule for myself that because I revere this book so much, I didn't want to deviate. I didn't want to change things. I wanted to translate the moments that I felt my way in into these characters based on something that there's textual evidence for in the book. It felt really, this is such an iconic story. It's our American story.
Yeah.
So anybody who thinks like something is, oh, but this isn't the book, I'd be like, I invite you to have a conversation with me. I'll point you to the section. And maybe, you know, people might be like, oh, that's a stretch. I'd be like, that's fine. It's, you know, it's public domain. Everyone can put their own lens on this like iconic story that is basically our, you know, our story. But it's my version in collaboration with these other creatives of a thing I deeply, deeply revere and want to make sure is respected by other people who love the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because it does feel like it belongs to all of us. You said it's an American story. Most of us probably read it if we went through the American school system. And then in those moments that you're kind of fleshing out or discussing with your collaborators, who decides, oh, and then a song goes here?
Well, there were a few songs written before. And so then, you know, those are some darlings that died as well. Like they're that, or like we're Frankenstein into something else. I guess it just sort of depends on everyone kind of decides like what's the audience actually. That's the answer. The audience decides. You can feel when no amount of like arguing for something is going to make an audience laugh at a thing that you think is funny. No amount of internal like debate about what should and what shouldn't is, and like, you know, given some time also, because like the first few goes, you know, it might be messy, might be whatever, but like if they're just not getting something. This is how I feel in workshops where like if an actor is generous and doing exactly what's on the page and they are bringing their full selves and it's still not working, it's my fault. But if the actor is not reading the thing and not doing it and they're just like making some shit up, I'm like, yo, like we need to adjust, because I'm not going to know again, like when my bones are dust, like these are the things which will transcend my finite life. Are these words that I have on a page, and if they can't live on beyond me or somebody else, like trying to explain them to other people, they're never gonna live beyond. They're never gonna live very, very long. So the audience is the ultimate arbiter of what stays in, what goes, what needs to be amended, what journey needs to be rescored, so that they can get the fullest experience of what our intentions are.
Yeah. I have two different questions. I want to go back to something you were saying earlier about how everything that we're seeing in this version of Gatsby is from the text. You went to the text. There's reason for it. And I've heard that there's some expansion on the queerness of some of the characters. Can you talk a little bit about that? Or is it for us to see when we experience the show ourselves?
Well, I can point you to the this is fun. I can point you to the section. It's the end of chapter two, where Nick is at he's just gone to Myrtle's party in Harlem, and he meets a man named Chester at the party. And the end of that chapter, he claims to have been only drunk twice in his life, and this was the second time. The writing actually ruptures. The writing style ruptures. It's been this like elegant prose throughout, and then there's like there's a fragmentary nature at the end of the chapter after he's been drunk and met this Manchester, where we see a shot of him in like at the bedside of this man who's in his underwear. He's a photographer and he's showing him some of his photographs, and then there's another sort of like, it's sort of like a blackout snapshot. Mm-hmm. Sort of we see. And then the last snapshot is he's in Penn Station. He's not quite sure how he got there, waiting for the train back home. And he's also a veteran who's just returned from World War I to go back home to the Midwest. And he feels like something is not right there. Something has broken. He feels restless and reckless in the language that comes from the book. And he has to leave. And so I'm like, you experienced death. You came back home to a place that might not see you fully. And you move to New York in hopes of a new beginning. And so that's my sort of snapshot of Nick and Jordan has their own sort of moments as well. But all of it is like just kind of teed up by the text for me. I mean, it's a sort of a Rorschach test of like, this is what I see. This is where this, and this is where I feel.
I literally bought a copy of The Great Gatsby this spring, and I am going to literally start reading it on my porch after we are done recording today, because there is some stuff with Jordan too that I remember. Yeah. That it's really interesting.
We've been going Gatsby like crazy here. I have one last thing I want to mention about or ask about it before we move on, unless Dylan, you have more questions, but this cast is crazy. I mean, it is some of the most exciting Broadway faves that are like the next gen of like, you know, Isaac Powell, Sleya Pfeiffer,
Ben Levi Ross,
Larry Ward. I think Larry, is that how you say it?
Ellery.
Oh my God. I mean, and I'm not familiar with the actress who's playing Daisy, but I've heard she's like an incredible singer. Oh my God. So as the writer, how much involvement do you have in casting, if any at all?
Extensive.
Ooh.
Because I choose to. I mean, they did a really, really wide reach, a really wide search for all of these actors, and I wasn't like at the initial, you know, like the first sort of the, I think the AD did a lot of those, and then and a number were filtered for like our consideration. I think it was maybe like a 6-month casting process. I mean, it was very, I think that's right, it was very, very long. And wow. It felt, I can't imagine not being involved with you. It's also, I auditions are like my workshop. I love it. I get to see different versions of the scene and different takes. And it's like a it's a free workshop for me to be like, what oh, what are the possibilities, and what's the alchemy and the chemistry of these two people if they read it, and like what's a possibility based on like what, you know, one person's I love it. So I'm like, try and keep me out of that room. Yeah, and it's just we also want to be in conversation to with each other as creatives to feel like, is this person going to be the collaborator that we want, that like ultimately brings this character to life? Yeah, so very extensive. I love it. I love being auditions are some of my favorite things.
Has that been the case with your other plays as well? Because I know that like you write what you know, and a lot of it, your experiences about with your mom and like Ironbound in particular. Have you been able to have a say in casting with other? Because I know you've worked with like MTC or like New York Theatre Workshop. Do they allow that as well?
Yeah, they again, Dramatists Guild, like we have final approval. They can't move forward. Sometimes, you know, there's a like the director might bring you folks, but you ultimately have like final approval. And luckily, all of the directors I've worked with and the theaters that I've worked with like very much want that voice there. And if they didn't, I would fight for it. because
Yes.
I'm like, let me help you. Like this came from my mind. From my mind. It is to say, I know this isn't what is on the page is a hypothesis. It is not the complete version, but it began with me. If I had all the answers, I would write novels, you know, in a room by myself and then just ship them off for, but I love this fusion of many voices and many personalities and life stories that then ultimately make a character. Like it all has to be filtered through me. I'm the one who's writing the words and picking and choosing like what I want to present, but I just it's such a beautiful process. So I just feel like the writer is let us help you. Like I remember going into it was I was like in tech one day for one of my earliest productions of Ironbound, and I was like, why is it day? Why is it so bright? And she was like, oh, it's day. I was like, no, girl, it says night right here. And she's like, oh, my bad. And then just like, I was like, you know, it's just it's definitely night. They talk about being 2 in the morning. As they help me, let me help you.
Right. Gosh, Martina, you're so funny in a lot of your plays, and this is like a loose quote I've read or described as being harsh, but also humorous and sort of combining these different elements. I'm curious about where that comes from and where your love of writing and the arts comes from. We call it the Ring of Keys moment. It's taken from Fun Home, where, you know, there's that moment of recognition where you realize this is the life you want to pursue and this is your passion. Do you feel like you saw a production or read something or experienced something that made you decide that this was the life for you?
I didn't see theater, period, until like my last year of high school. I grew up in North Jersey and the Newark, Carnegie Harrison area, the end of the PATH train. So I would see New York. I was in New York all the time, but I just felt like that world was not for me. It felt very exclusionary in cost, and I just felt like they, you know. But around that time, I used to hustle at a pool hall in high school for extra cash. The pool hall was literally called Guys and Dolls, but I did not make the fucking link.
That's
So
wild.
You moonlighted as a
the
hustler in a
pool
pool
hustler.
hall
Yeah,
in high
that's
school.
right. I also was a hostess in a Thai restaurant, a host of like, you know, full deep Jersey life. But I would, yeah, like sometimes hustle at a pool. And so one day I won $45, which is more than I'd ever won, because I play like $5 a game. So I took my like giant winnings home, and I was like, I must use this money towards something I never would have used it toward. I had to come about it in legal ways. Special money. Because also at the same time, like I joke, but like I helped my mom with rent. Like we grew up with no money. My mom cleaned her fucking houses. She still cleans houses. I have asked her to stop cleaning houses. I've asked her, can I pay you the amount of money you make cleaning a house? And she was like, can you pay me and I'll still clean the house and make double? I was like, this is not how this works. Is
Gotta
not
hustle you now.
what I'm asking, but good hustle, but good hustle. So I had this $45, and my mom, you know, mentioned she cleaned houses, and when people would often leave like magazines and pamphlets and things for her to recycle, and she would bring those home for me and my sister because she figured that was free reading material. And so one day she found this pamphlet for something called Cabaret. And she didn't know what it was, and I didn't know what it was, but she came into my room and she was like, Martina, John Stamos was in it. And so she brings home this pamphlet and she's like, Martina, Uncle Jesse's in New York. And I was like, oh my God, he is. And so I looked at the pamphlet. I was like, what the fuck is this? Cabaret, Sam Mendes, who are these people? But I saw the t cheapest tickets were $45. And so I was like, let's go. So I went to Studio fucking 54 with my $45, and I saw the iconic Cabaret production. At that point, Alan Cumming had been posed by Uncle Jesse. I mean, having never been in a theater, I sat there and I had my entire body shook by the like expansion of humanity that was like the voices coming through these finite human bodies who gathered today to tell me a story. Me specifically, I literally was welcomed. The first song welcomed me. It wanted me there. This world that I thought was not for me was saying welcome in many languages to me. As somebody who grew up in like a multicultural immigrant neighborhood too, I was like, I see that. I see you. Great. Thank you. Thank you. And then the story itself was, it didn't compromise the darkness that it contained, and it still was generous. It was bawdy and sexy and dirty and fucking grimy, and I loved it. And it still wanted, it still wanted me there. It wanted me to have a good time. It wanted me to laugh. It wanted me to cry. It wanted me to be shocked. It wanted to do things to me and for me. And I was like, I need to devote my life to doing what this story did to me, to other people. I just felt the most alive I'd ever felt, and the closest to transcendence of something that was meaningful in that moment. And I hope that anything I've made has come close to touching a soul in the way that that experience did for me.
Wow. I can guarantee you it has. That is so, so powerful. First of all, was he good, John Stamos?
Oh, he was fantastic. I mean, yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Fantastic.
I picture the suspenders. I remember the costumes from that. Shirtless with the suspenders. And yeah.
And he can sing. I mean, he did a stint on the hit television series Glee, where he did perform songs as a singing dentist.
He did.
which was hot.
I then met him, like, I met him at the opening of Some Like It Hot, and I was like, sir, I need to share this story with you. He was like, I'll put it in my memoir. I'm like, thanks.
That's so cute. Well, I also have to say, congrats on winning a Pulitzer. I mean, is that... I can't let this end without telling you, like, that is a gag and a half. Like, do you ever just, like, remember sometimes, wait, I won.
That I was telling you earlier before we started recording, like how meaningful it is to be on this podcast because of feeling like it's you're amplifying the stories that I tell, and that's the most meaningful thing for me, and that's what the Pulitzer ultimately, that's the heart swell of that experience, was feeling like there was a validation for the type of stories and that story in particular that like may have been relegated to the sidelines, that there's somebody who's saying, I know this is worth our attention. This, you know, most precious of resources, our attention. And also these actors are it's like should go on, and people should see them, and should open opportunities for other actors that should be seen. I felt like I don't matter. I felt like that's been the desire to write in the first place, was my mother making herself invisible, because that was, you know, as an undocumented immigrant woman in domestic violence situation, that was the safest place that she could be. And to me, silence is not safety. It's the opposite of safety. And so writing feels like shining that light, and also on also myself, and understanding bits of myself, and to have fucking Pulitzer Prizes be like, we see you. We celebrate you. I lost my mind. I lost my fucking mind.
It's crazy.
Is it like a physical award too? Like, do you have
it?
See
it? Yeah.
Is it heavy?
Okay, like, do you want to see it?
Yeah. Yeah, honestly, I'm curious.
This is my Pulitzer crystal.
Oh my gosh.
It looks like a weapon.
I know.
It's very sharp. And
oh
then,
my gosh.
You know, I have to get this. I actually haven't gotten it framed, but this is my, it's like a diploma.
Oh,
I've had
that's so cool.
From Columbia University. I've had friends come in. They're like, I don't know, I went to Columbia. Oh, it's a Pulitzer. I was like, yes.
That's so cool.
Well, there are so many things I would love to talk to you about, but we are coming up on our time. So we're going to have you back at some point down the line, because I want to talk about your other major plays that you have had produced and done and everything like that.
I know. Dylan and I separately were both like, we were talking before this. We were like, wait, we need to see Queens. Like,
yes.
Actually, I'm so moved that you bring, that's a play I feel like it, I never quite got right.
Mm.
And I picked it up just this past month. And I feel like I'm scared to say on a podcast, but I really want to revive it. I want to, like, I feel like I let these women down. It's a story of a group of immigrant women who live together. And I just didn't feel like I got their story fully as full as it could have been. And so I'm coming back to it. So hopefully they'll come back.
It's so exciting.
I know. We were both just so, like I said to Connor, I was like, I need to see a production of Queens. Like I need to read it at the very least.
I haven't even published it. I didn't share it with the, I just felt like I really didn't get it right. And so I just kept it cloistered.
as a writer, does that thought of being unfinished with characters I don't want to say haunt you, but does that?
It absolutely. That was the word I was going to. Yes, it absolutely haunts me. It's haunted me for years. I tried to make it into a series with at HBO.
Oh.
And I was like, this is not the right form either. Like, it has to be play. And I think I some lovely friends of mine gathered during a thunderstorm, like in Brooklyn, to like do a little, it became like a seance, but it was the salon. My live stream is to have like salons at a long table in my apartment, and like
yes.
wine stains on the pages. Like, this is my dream. And we did that, and we read the first like 130 pages, because the play is quite long, the okay. first 130 pages of the play. And I felt like I'd like touched those people's stories again, and I got to resurrect them in, and they felt so like pulsing with life and alive and asking to be finished, to have their stories like fully realized. And so now I'm trying. I'm very afraid. It's scary because I love them so much and I don't want to let them down. That's what I'm doing now, spending time with these women and hope to give them a full life.
That's so beautiful. Excited. You will. You will. I have a feeling.
I know. As Dylan said, we could talk to you forever, but we are sadly wrapping up. We end on a dose of drama. This is that little thing that's in our heads that's maybe a rant. Maybe it's a rave. Maybe it's something we've been thinking about while walking down the street, or what we've been binge watching, what we've been reading, et cetera, et cetera. And my dose of drama today is a little more introspective. I usually share a little recommendation, but having just come back from Palm Springs, and this trip came, it was a true vacation for our friend Isaac's birthday, and it turned into an engagement for him, which was amazing.
Oh,
so great. Exciting.
Congratulations.
Yes. this vacation could not have come at a better time in my life. As a reminder to slow the hell down, I was burning the candle at both ends right beforehand, losing my mind a little bit. And I want to stay in the mindset of like taking things a little slower, not always trying to squeeze as much as possible into the day, and just try to like be gentle with myself and my life, and just not be rushing to make it to every single thing all the time and do a million things. Just try to be a little more zen. So that's my hope for the rest of summer, is to be more zen, more gentle with myself, and just enjoy life. Like as if I'm floating in the pool at Palm Springs still. So hopefully I can do that. Dylan, do you have a dose of drama?
I do. So I have been watching season 3 of The Bear, not a comedy. I just have to say, you know, the first episode, I was definitely not slapping my knees or anything with laughter, but
it's a dramedy. It's a dramedy.
Sure. But fun little connection today, David Zayas was in Cost of Living, and his wife, who is on the show, is Liza, is her name?
Liza, yeah.
My favorite character, episode 6, Napkins, my favorite episode of the season. Oh. She is incredible. I know that awards don't mean everything, but I really do think that this could be her Emmy's work.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh my God. Oh, that makes me so happy to hear.
And he's so warm and wonderful in everything that he does. And so I recommend it. I haven't finished the season yet, so I can't really compare it to the other two, but it's always an interesting watch, The Bear. Have you watched it, Martina?
Oh God, yes. We're at episode, we just finished episode 3. So I'm sure it's episode 4 tonight. The only reason we didn't was because our television broke.
Okay, that's drama. What are you gonna do?
It's come back. We have a new TV, but yeah, I saw
amazing.
David. I saw David. I knew that he was gonna be popping in. So I was so happy to see him at first. Yeah, they're beautiful. They're beautiful.
I think episode 3 stressed me the hell out. Yeah. So you've made it through.
Like, it stressed the TV out too. It had to shut down.
I did, but I love that. Like, every episode is its own distinct little world. Mm-hmm. I have such deep respect for that show and their structure.
Yes, it's really cool. I'm excited to finish it. I'll do that and read Gatsby today. Anyways, Martina, will you take us home with your own dose of drama? Like Connor said, it could be anything.
I think, Connor, you and I are like actually we're in similar headspaces, because I've been thinking about the finality of life and just how much time we have and what you fill your hours with. And I think that there's this expectation to be a machine, even in the arts, to just kind of produce, but there needs to be like a filling of the well in moments. And I feel like that's what summer is this like filling of a well, looking at the scatterings of your life up to this point on the floor and being like, what is here? And where do I want to go? And like figuring out what the map of the next year is going to be, the next few years. And I think for the first time in my life, it's not been what I hold most dear is like love and relationships and the people that make me feel like my soul is alight. And wanting to give that love back to them instead of just constantly making and making and making, because there's this scarcity mindset that if I stop working, it's all going to go away. Mm. Somebody will take any bit of safety I've ever had in my life if I'm ever happy. And so I'm like, well, what is a life? And perhaps like I've worked up to this point at the intensity that I've worked, and I've missed on. There's a song in Gatsby that's his song about where he comes from, called Mr. Nobody from Nowhere. Oh fuck, tears again. Where he sings about the things that he has built and all the things that he's done, but also the things that he's missed.
Mm.
And I'm at a place where I would like to rebuild the things that I feel like maybe I've missed. And the core of that is love and people and friendships and Bobby, and like largely Bobby. Like it's a treasuring of the love that I'm very, very lucky to get to have.
Beautiful send off today. That was so magical. I mean, you're such an amazing writer, but you are really very eloquent as well, not just in the written way. And I think a lot of people will relate to that. Summer is the best time to take stock of all those things too.
You two are such lights. You're just a joy. It's so wonderful to talk to you.
Thank you.
Thank you so
that
much.
That means the world.
Oh, so sweet. And everybody's got to go see Gatsby. I think it's mostly sold out through the end of the run, but if you can get a ticket.
I'll try.
You know, it's a trek. It's quite far. But I'll tell you, there's some great cannolis in Boston. Like there's.
Oh, I love cannolis. And you guys have got to go and see, like, does Isaac Powell like strip nude? Well, we can only find out if we see it.
Yeah, yonder bags.
Yes, exactly.
I love it. Well, thank you so much for your time. Like, we are truly such fans, and you're such a wonderful person. So thank you for spending your Friday with us. Everybody's got to support you, buy your plays, and follow you on Instagram. It's your name with an underscore in the middle.
And while everyone's following Martine, they've got to follow us. We're at The Drama Podcast. Connor is at Connor McDowell. I'm at Dylan McDowell. Thank you again, Martina. This really meant a lot to us.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
And Connor, I will see you next time.
Drama.